From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The new rules for immigration enforcement released by the Trump administration yesterday mark a big change from the previous rules. Millions in the country illegally could face deportation. White House spokesman Sean Spicer said President Trump wants to take the shackles off federal enforcement agents in the Department of Homeland Security.
The message from this White House and from the DHS is that those people who are in this country and pose a threat to our public safety or have committed a crime will be the first to go.
The rules call for prioritizing the deportation of anyone in the country illegally who's been accused of or who's been convicted of committing any crime, even a traffic violation, or who is a recent border crosser. So what does that mean for people living illegally in the U.S.? Saida Hassan is a reporter at KUT News in Austin, Texas, and she joins us now. Saida, there's a lot of anxiety out there about these new rules and the way they'll be implemented. You've been talking with people out there in the construction and other industries. What are you hearing?
I have, Eric. I talked with one undocumented worker who came to Austin from Mexico about 16 years ago, and he says he's been working in the construction industry ever since. And he told me that he does feel afraid in light of the recent immigration enforcement actions, but he's still been reporting to work in part because he doesn't feel like he has much of a choice, being that he's the chief breadwinner of the family. But it certainly seems that there is a sense of fear and concern over what to expect amongst undocumented workers when they're reporting for work.
And uncertainty out there. You were at a community meeting last night. Tell us a little about that, what you heard.
Sure. I went to a community meeting last night hosted by a group called the Workers' Defense Project. And they're a nonprofit that advocates for construction workers here in Texas. And basically, this meeting was a space for workers and their families to talk about their concerns, share information, and get guidance on what to do if they are approached by immigration enforcement officers and what their rights are. So organizers say that there has been a great deal of confusion and unpredictability around the recent changes to immigration policy about what exactly the priorities for enforcement are. And they told workers that regardless of their immigration status, they have a right to remain silent if they're approached by immigration and customs enforcement, and also just inform them about some resources here in the Austin community that they can turn to for help.
And was it well attended? Did a lot of people show up?
It certainly was. There were about 20 or so workers that I met with, and also several of their family members were also there looking to learn more.
What about those who employ undocumented workers in and around your area? What are you hearing there?
Sure. I talk with Phil Thoden. He is the president of the Austin chapter of the Associated General Contractors. So Phil told me that he checked in with several builders last week. He wanted to know if they'd seen any changes after the National Day Without Immigrants protest, which, as you know, was a day where some workers chose not to report to work in protest of these recent changes to immigration policies. So Phil told me that some local builders here in Austin have noticed a change in their staffing. Some say that they've had just a few workers missing in recent days. But there are others that say that the current political climate has had a big impact on their workers not showing up. Some of their projects have slowed down significantly because workers don't feel safe reporting to these construction sites.
So about half of the industry's Hispanic undocumented workers. Couldn't this affect the economy in your area?
Sure. I think that's a key thing to follow going forward. The Workers' Defense Project actually did a study with the University of Texas at Austin a few years ago, which estimates that about 50% of construction workers here in Texas are undocumented. So if those folks don't feel comfortable and are afraid to show up to work, this could potentially have a big impact on Texas businesses.
All right. We'll be following all of this in the days ahead. Saida Hassan, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Saida Hassan is a reporter at KUT News in Austin, Texas.
Well, 2 p.m. local time today is the deadline for people to evacuate the protest camp near the Dakota Access Pipeline site in North Dakota. A couple hundred people are still at the camp, which is on federal land between the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation and the pipeline route. The Army Corps of Engineers says the camp needs to be evacuated because of the danger of possible spring flooding. The governor of North Dakota, Doug Burgum, told me on Friday that if the camp floods, huge amounts of trash and debris from the camp will wind up in the river.
This is, you know, a month ahead of schedule in terms of the melt. We've got hundreds of abandoned vehicles in this area, propane tanks that were there used and abandoned for heat sources this winter. All that stuff could be floating down the Missouri River. And as people recall, this whole thing began with the idea of water protectors, and now we find ourselves in this tremendous irony, which is the people that sought to protect the water have created one of the largest ecological messes on the entire Missouri River system this year.
Well, Madonna Thunderhawk is one of the people still living at the camp. She's of the Two Kettles Lakota tribe. We spoke with her yesterday, and she took issue with much of what the governor had to say about the need for cleanup and evacuation of the camp.
Any protesters that are going to try to stop cleanup, we're doing clean. We've been doing, you know, cleanup on our own. They come in armed to the teeth, and that's cleanup? Come on.
James McPherson is a reporter with the Associated Press. He joins us today by cell phone from the camp, which is very remote and doesn't have great cell phone reception. So maybe turn up the radio and lean in. James, tell us about the scene there right now.
The rain's calmed down a little bit. It's just muck and mud here at the camp. There's dozens of law enforcement that have been massed outside of the camp. I'm estimating 150 to 200 people still remain in the camp. Earlier today, some of the structures were set ablaze.
Were set ablaze?
Yes, by the protesters themselves.
Why is that? Why did they light the structures on fire?
One fellow told us that it was done out of celebration.
Is the camp cleaned up for the most part, as the governor had asked them to do?
No. It certainly is smaller in size and population than it has been. I've been coming down here basically since April. But there's still quite a bit of refuge on the ground here. It's flooded over from the fall. We had a lot of snow here.
Now, the governor had made the case that people had to clear out because of the risk of flooding as the snow starts to melt and the river rises. What are you seeing in terms of flood risk right now?
As far as flood risk, the river is, we've had warmer temperatures here. We have talked to some local Sioux who said this are some of the worst conditions they have seen in their life, that they believe it surely will flood at some point. The camp itself is about a half square mile, and it's in a low-lying area at the confluence of the Missouri and the Cannonball Rivers. So if you get an ice jam or a real fast melt, this water will come into this area.
But the protesters do not believe that it's going to be a risk for them.
I don't know if that's the case. I just think some are holding on out of defiance.
You've been talking to people there. What have they been saying to you?
Some are telling us they are going to leave peacefully. Some have told us they're staying and holding on or moving to other camps. There have been other camps established outside of here.
What does this mean for the pipeline construction?
The construction is ongoing. They're drilling right now beneath the Missouri River. Actually, it's Lake Oahe. It's a reservoir of the Missouri River. They began that a couple of weeks ago. And the timeline on that, they've said anywhere from 30 to 60 days to complete this pipeline. And it's about a mile or so north of the camp where the pipeline traverses here.
That's James McPherson, who's a reporter with the Associated Press, joining us from the protest camp in North Dakota against the Dakota Access Pipeline. James, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And again, the deadline for evacuation, 2 p.m. local time today. Well, lawmakers across the country have been hearing from angry constituents this week as they return home on recess. Demonstrators held a town hall without Ted Cruz outside the senator's Houston office yesterday. Andrew Schneider from Here and Now contributor Houston Public Media reports.
Demonstrators lined up six deep for more than half a block outside Senator Cruz's Houston office on Travis Street. They came to express their frustration against actions by President Trump and the Republican-led Congress. I waded through the crowd and spoke with more than a dozen people. Most told a variation on the same story. Here's how protester Jane Moser told it.
Everybody in this line has been trying for weeks to talk to people in the office, to get answers to questions. He sends a form letter, maybe. He cuts off his phone lines. He does various things to keep from hearing. We're wanting a town hall.
Another demonstrator, Chris Griffith, went so far as to hand deliver a note to one of the senator's staffers.
You know, we're his constituents. We may not have voted for him, but clearly Trump is a disaster. And if he wants to be taken seriously at the next election, he needs to listen to us.
Following a bitterly contested primary last year, Cruz eventually endorsed Trump for president. He's since voted in favor of all Trump's cabinet nominees. The senator ultimately did meet with a handful of protesters inside his office. The demonstrators described the meeting as cordial. However, Cruz would not commit to any town hall meetings with constituents this year. For Here and Now, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
The Academy Awards are coming up this Sunday, Hollywood's biggest night. And the man who will co-produce the Oscars is Mike DeLuca. He has produced critically acclaimed films including The Social Network, Captain Phillips, and Moneyball. He's also produced both Fifty Shades of Grey and its sequel, Fifty Shades Darker. And this Sunday, he and co-producer Jennifer Todd will take on the challenge of the Oscars. He joins us for this week's View from the Top, our series of conversations with leaders. Mike DeLuca, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So as a producer of Oscar contenders like Moneyball, you've attended the Oscars. Now you're in charge. What's it like to be on the other side?
It's pretty fun, I have to say. It's probably the closest I'll get to producing a Broadway musical. It's immediate. It's urgent. You know, it's different than obviously the scripted stuff I've done. It's just very in the moment. So it's an exciting change of pace for me.
What are the challenges right now?
Running time. You know, the challenges are, you know, we've pretty much book the show. We know the presenters. We know the original content that we've brought to it. We know this, you know, the nominated songs, and we like all of it. So now it's a question of, you know, can we fit it into that box that doesn't have people the following day go, wow, that was a long award show,
which they do every time, right? I mean,
I think you're going to get that no matter what, but we want to do the best we can to mitigate it.
But how do you do that when so much of the Oscars is not really in your control because it's speeches that people are giving?
My partner on the show, Jennifer Todd, and I, we approached it from the point of view of, you know, what we can affect that might, you know, create the impression of a show that was really entertaining or that moved quickly, even if you're locked into a certain running time. And yes, you're right, the speeches may push you a little bit, but we also have kind of control over that too, because we have the button that triggers the playoff music after 45 seconds. But we thought, let's look at it from the point of view of, let's not let too much time go by between giving out awards. That creates the impression of a slow show. You know, let's try and not have a slow slog or a slow area, you know, in the middle, you know, where people kind of check out. Let's have something fun every, you know, every couple of acts. So we've tried to attack that problem, not literally in terms of making the show, you know, shorter in spots, but just making sure it's entertaining all the way through.
Now, you mentioned the playoff music. I'm wondering, what is the line that gets crossed where somebody gets up there, is talking for a while, you bring on the playoff music, and then they stop the playoff music, which I feel like has happened in the past, where they say, right, no, let me finish. I'm going to finish my thought.
It's really fluid. It's such an unpredictable situation. We're really going to try not to use it if someone is like reaching the peak of a really moving speech. But it's very subjective. It's really what Jen and I and the director feel is really moving. If we feel like you're droning and you're not being particularly, you know, wise, it's very subjective, but we'll hit that music. But we told people at the nominees luncheon, you know, through this funny short film we commissioned from Kate McKinnon, you got 45 seconds. That 45 seconds starts the minute you get up out of your seat. It doesn't start when you're at the stage. So rehearse, practice, you know, fit it in that 45 seconds, including your walk up, and don't wing it, and you should be okay.
You think a lot of actors in Hollywood right now are practicing in the mirror what they're going to say?
It's a mixed bag. I bet a few people, especially people who've been there before, probably rehearse and practice, and, you know, they're professionals and don't want to waste that time. Some people, you know, are really overtaken in the moment, overwhelmed, honestly, by emotion, and do wing it by accident because they're so deer in the headlights. So you usually get a mixed bag.
The Golden Globes this year got pretty political with some of the winners, including Meryl Streep in particular, taking the opportunity to make comments about President Trump. Are you expecting this to be a very political Oscars?
You know, I think it's in the air. So, you know, even before all the recent stuff, we thought, you know, just the nature of these shows, no matter what's going on in the world, there's a topicality creeps in because it's, you know, the winners get up there and it's their moment in the spotlight and they speak from the heart. And that may include current events if they're socially minded. So there's always a degree of it. I think there's more of it, you know, in the air because of recent events. But I'm of two minds about it. I'm a free speech warrior. I think everyone, you know, liberals and conservatives should be allowed to speak their mind. I don't really agree with the pejorative, like, shut up and sing, you know, thing that's given to a lot of celebrities just because they're celebrities. But I also think the Oscars aren't an op-ed page. I think the Oscars celebrate excellence in the field of filmmaking. And, it should be kind of an island of just, you know, celebration of those things within the industry. But again, you know, it's not my place to control, and I can't even control, even if I wanted to, what people say. We're just kind of grab onto the, you know, the railing and hold on for the ride and see what happens.
Now, you're producing a show that really has two audiences, the millions of people who are going to be watching on TV, and then the audience in the Dolby Theater, which contains most of Hollywood's movers and shakers. How do you plan a show so that you keep both of those groups happy?
By really focusing on the universality of why we're all there. You know, I really believe that even for the people in the audience, in the theater, and the people watching abroad and at home here, it's the love of movies and the magical moments that we've all shared at the movies. I do think that's a universal language. So we've tried to stay focused on celebrating the work, both the work from this year and the work from years past. We think that's where the people in the theater, the people at home in this country and watching abroad all meet, in this place of really being moved by movies.
I want to just ask you a little bit about your career, because you've been in the business for decades, starting as an intern in the 80s with New Line Cinema. You had some huge successes there, executive producing Magnolia and Boogie Nights. But you also had a reputation as a big partier. You had a series of flops and you got fired. What was it that turned your career around, or your life around even?
Well, two different things. The career, it never really gets turned around, because there are and I learned this early, because I, you know, came out of the gate strong with 2 years of hits, and then I got, you know, I don't know if I can say this on the air, I got slapped pretty bad by a year of flops, and you realize, you know, I learned that lesson then, that everybody has flops, everybody, but not everybody has hits. So as long as I could continue to kind of, you know, the business is cyclical, and I would comfort myself with, whenever I was in a spell of, you know, gee, that year didn't work out so well, I do feel like the hits are right around the corner, because hope springs eternal, and you almost need that optimism to continue in the business. So the career is a circle to me. Like, it never really turned around, but it turns. It does turn, and you have your good years and your bad years. On the life lessons front, you know, it's probably a pretty cliched story, but I was a complete geek, bookish nerd growing up, didn't have a fun adolescence, had one as an adult in full view of the industry, not smart, didn't realize it at the time. Realized, you know, towards the end of it, that I wanted hearth and home and children and a partner. And once you decide that, you kind of order things to allow that to happen. And that's been kind of my journey.
Would you say you put your career second in that case?
No, I don't think that they're competitive. Like, I think, you know, as long as you're good about scheduling, you can have it all. You can have your career and make time for family, you know, your partner and your kids. It just requires scheduling.
One of your most critically acclaimed films as a producer was the 2010 film The Social Network, the David Fincher, Aaron Sorkin film about the founding of Facebook. And I have to say that as a business journalist at the time, after watching that film, I came in and said to my bosses, we've got to do so much more tech news coverage, because this is fascinating what's going on. What was it about that film that made you want to take it on? And how does that film rank in all of the films that you've worked on in your mind?
Oh, it's at the top, or, you know, with a few other ones in terms of a working experience, because I really do worship at the altar of Scott Rudin and David Fincher and Aaron Sorkin, and you know, my partner on that film, Dana Brunetti, and I, we couldn't believe our good fortune that Scott and Aaron wanted to join that project, that produced the script that eventually attracted David Fincher. But it was based on a nonfiction book by Ben Mezrich, The Accidental Billionaires. And what I responded to, and I think what we all responded to, that Aaron kind of put in one meeting so beautifully, is the theme of the story kind of was what you lose when you win. And, you know, at least in our version and Aaron's version of the Zuckerberg journey, in the beginning, it was about, you know, the trade-off that happened for that character achieving the professional goal but causing friction in that relationship with his friend Eduardo. So that human level story is what really attracted us all.
And so what attracted you then to the 50 Shades franchise, which is about as far as you could get from The Social Network?
You know, I love titillation. Like, I like sexy stuff. I think a lot of people do. And I thought the author was really brilliant in her execution of this, but wrapped, you know, deep inside that story is a very conservative, traditional love conquers all, love redeems all archetype. It's a little bit Cinderella, you know, the princess being whisked up to the prince's castle. It's a little bit Beauty and the Beast. It's a little bit, you know, a lot of these things that have survived over the centuries because of being very powerful archetypes. So I thought, despite the S&M bells and whistles, which it's not really about, it's really a very beautiful kind of redemptive love story. That character, Christian Grey, is healed from his childhood trauma by this woman's true love. And it's the story of a couple with issues that eventually makes it work, and they end up having a kid at the end. They become a nuclear family. So I thought that was an incredible hat trick she pulled off. And a lot of people that haven't read the books or don't really pay attention to the movies miss that that's probably a big part of why it became so popular.
What's your all-time favorite movie, by the way?
Lawrence of Arabia is my all-time favorite.
Lawrence of Arabia. What's next for you after the Oscars? Or do you want to do it again? Do you think you're ready to come back next year?
Look, man, I'm on record. I've told them, like, I would like to come back. Jen and I would both like to come back because next year is the 90th anniversary. And I start to, like, drool over it. Man, if I get my hands on the 90th anniversary show, that would be really fun because I love film history. So we're on record kind of groveling for the job already. We'll see if we'll get picked. But I guess it'll depend on how we're received on Monday morning.
That's movie producer Mike DeLuca. He and Jennifer Todd are going to be co-producing this Sunday's Academy Awards. Mike DeLuca, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, man. It was a pleasure.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Relationships are important. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and Blue Apron makes cooking together fun and easy. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. So join in, get the family together, and choose your meals each week. They come to your door with pre-measured ingredients so you can spend time with your family and not at the grocery store. With the simple instructions, everyone can help prepare the meal. There's no risk. Get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
So here's the good news. People are living longer, especially women in South Korea. The not-so-good news, Americans are on track to have the lowest life expectancy of wealthy countries by 2030. That's according to a new study from the WHO and Imperial College London. BBC correspondent James Gallagher joins us now from London. And James, the study predicts that South Korean women will be the first in the world to have an average life expectancy above 90. What's going on there? A lot of exercise, healthy kimchi?
Oh, yeah, great food. It's always got to be great food. I think what is going on there on the biggest scale is actually that all those little things that add up to improving life expectancy is happening for everybody, or at least a large proportion of the population. When you have health benefits, it's not just benefiting the incredibly rich, it's also helping the poorest people in society. And that includes everything from education to nutrition to new medical breakthroughs.
So South Korea is taking better care of people, education, health care, and earlier in their lives as well.
Exactly. And I hate to break this to you, but this is what the researchers were describing was the exact opposite of the approach that's happening in the United States. Now, you can probably tell me more than I can tell you about it. But there they were saying the discrepancy between the richest and the poorest people in society in terms of what's happening with their life expectancies. But it's what's happening in the poorest people that's dragging the whole population figure down.
Well, let's talk a little more about the American numbers. The U.S. is the only developed nation without universal health care. So where are U.S. men and women in this study?
Pretty far down as far as the rich countries are. It's the bottom. I can show you what's going to happen between 2015 and 2030 in terms of average life expectancies. Mm-hmm. So for men, it goes up from 77 to 79 years, and for women from 82 to 83 years. But it's more the countries that the U.S. is keeping with here that is sometimes surprising, because you'd expect, just looking at the overall wealth figures, for it to be doing really well and having really high life expectancies like other countries like France and South Korea. But it tends to cluster with lower or middle-income countries, so places like Croatia and Mexico.
Well, it's great that life expectancy is going up, but James, what about on the other end, people living longer? Has economic and policy implications for every country. Talk a little bit about that.
So what you're predicting is having a far greater graying population in the future. Now, that asks big questions. For example, pensions. Lots of pension schemes aren't really built to keep you going for decades after you retire. What about care for the elderly? I mean, these are big questions. I mean, I know it's being had all around the world, and nowhere's really coming up with the great answer as to how we afford to look after people once they leave work.
Big questions about retirement and elder care. James, overall around the world, women live longer than men on average. Are men simply drinking and smoking more and doing more naughty things? What does the research say about that gender gap?
One of the things that's quite curious is if you go back far enough in time, then the gender gap isn't really there. I mean, when people were dying of smallpox or when there were no antibiotics, now it's a lot of lifestyle-related risk factors are controlling when we die. And so if you look at what's happened through the 20th century, men started smoking sooner than women did. They drank more, and they generally drove more and therefore involved in a lot more car crashes. That's a major cause of death that we don't often think about. And so what's happened over time is that as lifestyle behaviours become more alike between men and women, as it were, that actually life expectancy is becoming more alike as well.
James Gallagher is health and science reporter for the BBC in London. James, here's to your health.
Thank you very much. See you at my 100th birthday.
Will do. Boisterous town hall meetings have sent Republican congresspeople looking for cover in their home districts, with some representatives opting not to hold public meetings at all. Yesterday, a group of Miami voters packed the waiting room at Republican Representative Ileana Ross Layton's office to demand a town hall meeting to talk about health care. From Here and Now contributor WLRN, Rowan Moore Garrity reports.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. Hi.
This is quite the group.
Yes. Hi. Yes, we are all together.
Okay.
You get the sense that Ileana Ross Layton's field office in Miami doesn't often see a dozen frustrated constituents show up in person to air their grievances.
She could have avoided this.
That's Derek Merlot.
I mean, this seems very confrontational, but this is not how we started. We started with a bunch of very polite people calling her office and writing letters and writing emails and having extended conversations with her staffers.
That was in December. Over the next 3 months, Merlot says, phone calls went unanswered, emails were not returned, and requests for a schedule of Ross Layton's public appearances were repeatedly rebuffed. Merlot's wife, April, says she's a lifelong Democrat who crossed party lines to support Ross Layton in a district that went overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton.
And I voted for her because I hoped and trusted that she would listen to constituent concerns, and that's why I'm here.
There was no formal organization leading the charge, just a group of voters who share a church or a workplace who got together online to push for a public meeting about the future of the Affordable Care Act. Lawmakers around the country are now discovering that avoiding public meetings over voters' concerns can invite a different kind of criticism. Here's Kathy Hirsch, who came along with another member from her Quaker meeting.
I'm concerned about Obamacare, but my main concern right now is access to our representatives.
As far as Obamacare goes, Ross Layton's district is home to more people who got coverage through the Affordable Care Act's exchanges than anywhere else in the country.
People in this district will die if ACA is repealed and not replaced with something equivalent or better.
That's South Miami resident Kirsten Wood. She says the law is important even to people like her with employer-based health insurance.
I didn't know until the ACA repeal talk started how much my health care is better because of the ACA. I am not the kind of meet with your Congress people political animal. So this is new and frankly difficult for me. And it's incredibly disheartening to realize how hard it is to get access to our representative.
After a short wait, the voters went in four at a time to talk with Ross Layton's chief of staff. Librarian Paige Morgan was among the first to come back out.
I felt as though we were stonewalled and just given excuses.
Ross Layton's office declined a request to interview the congresswoman. In a statement, she said she values constituent feedback but can't accommodate every request for a meeting. Her office didn't respond to questions about how long constituents should have to wait to have their phone calls returned. For Here and Now, I'm Rowan Moore Garrity in Miami.
Recently, parts of two spillways at California's massive Oroville Dam, the nation's tallest, crumbled in heavy rains. The damage sparked the evacuation of nearly 200,000 people. Built in 1968, Oroville holds back a reservoir containing more than 1 trillion gallons of water, supplying farms and cities across the state. The problems at Lake Oroville raise serious questions about dam infrastructure in California and around the nation. Martin McCann is director and founder of Stanford University's National Performance of Dams program. He joins us now from the Stanford campus in Palo Alto, California. Martin, welcome to Here and Now, and start with the dam. At this point, how much do we know really about what went wrong there?
Well, I think really knowing what happened and why is going to take some forensics evaluations and really looking into everything from the construction, the design, the operation over its lifetime, and then, of course, the details of the event itself.
Some California environmental groups had warned that these spillways were not adequate, particularly the emergency spillway at Orville. Didn't they have a point?
Well, they certainly had a point in the sense of the adequacy with regard to dealing with flows over the spillway, and their implication was that they would be damaged and the project may suffer considerable damage. You know, this event, the fact that it was the first to flow over the spillway and the flow rates were so low, actually, really emphasizes their point.
Now, that dam is more than 50 years old, as are more than half of California's nearly 1,600 dams. Does that make these dams more likely to have serious problems like we saw at Orville?
Well, certainly conventional wisdom would suggest that. But that being said, dams actually perform well, even in advanced age, so to speak. What does change over time are our understanding of how dams will perform, our sense of what is adequate changes, and certainly things deteriorate over time. So my view is even a relatively young dam, 10, 15 years old, still needs a lot of attention, a lot of due diligence in terms of inspections, keeping up with maintenance, identifying potential failure modes that may be appearing, and dealing with them in a timely manner.
Let's talk about the potential seriousness of what might have happened if there had been a massive failure at the dam beyond the spillways. We're talking about loss of life in the thousands, potentially.
Certainly the implication that nearly 200,000 people had to be evacuated would suggest that a lot of people would have been at risk. Experience suggests that with ample warning, people do get out of the way of floods. But certainly in this case, the expectation would be that a large population would have been at risk had the dam failed.
Martin, high-hazard dams are supposed to be inspected yearly, but the San Francisco Chronicle reports that as of October 2015, about a dozen high-hazard dams had gone more than 2 years between inspections. Doesn't that worry you?
It does a little bit. There are nuances, frankly, to that data. For instance, you know, should they be inspected within exactly 12 months or any time within the year? So in general, yes, they should definitely be inspected every year. I did see that report. I don't know if it's an accounting detail or whether they're truly way over their inspection interval.
I live in California when I'm not on the road for work. And, you know, my family prepares for earthquakes. We have some emergency plans and blankets and food like many, many Californians. And cities help with that preparation. Where does California rank when it comes to emergency plans for dams and flooding? And should the state do more?
Well, I don't know where they rank numerically with regard to emergency action plans. I can say that the country as a whole has struggled with this. You know, it is recommended that high and significant hazard dams have emergency action plans, and we're not doing good enough in California or in the country as a whole. And the emergency action plan is only part of the problem. It has to be developed, obviously. It has to be shared with the community, county emergency managers, and it has to be shared with the public so that the public understands where their neighborhoods are relative to the inundation area. So there's really a lot that needs to be done in terms of making a community safe so that families can protect themselves.
So in your view, California has a pretty good dam safety program, but where can the state improve and what can other states around the nation learn from that?
I think the Oroville event for California in particular and really for the nation as a whole is going to teach us some lessons here and really make us reflect on the job we're doing in dam safety. And I suspect that we're going to see improvements as a result of understanding what exactly happened and why. I think we'll see improvements in our inspection processes. Yeah. I think we'll see improvements in decision-making with regard to dam safety modifications that get made, whether it's a spillway like we had at Oroville or other aspects of dam projects.
So increased vigilance with a little extra money for more maintenance?
Definitely more money for maintenance and for making what we call dam safety modifications, where a real major structural change has to be made to dams. There's a great need for that. But I think also in terms of our general practices, I think we're going to learn some lessons here, some of which are yet to be uncovered, that will change the way we do business.
That's Martin McCann, director and founder of Stanford University's National Performance of Dams program. He also teaches civil and environmental engineering at Stanford. Martin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Looking down from 2 miles above the surface of the Earth, it's impossible not to be impressed by the sheer grandeur and splendor and power of the natural world.
That's Sir David Attenborough in a hot air balloon narrating the opening of the new series Planet Earth 2. It took more than 3 years to film in 40 countries to present a stunning look at Earth. It comes 10 years after Planet Earth was first released, and advances in filming technology give an even clearer, closer look at wildlife in some of the most remote places on the planet. Joining us now is Justin Anderson, who's a producer for Planet Earth 2. Justin, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And it's just a beautiful series, just as the first one was. This includes episodes on different habitats, islands, mountains, jungles, deserts, grasslands, and cities. You produced the mountains episode. How long did it take to figure out where to film and how to film animals in such remote, hard-to-get-to places?
Oh, well, we had 3.5 years to make the production from start to finish. So we had quite a long period of planning at the beginning, probably about 6 months of planning, where we did all our research and looked into different stories and worked out what we could actually film for real. So a very long process indeed.
Which were the hardest animals to find and to film?
Well, I think for the mountain show, I mean, all the animals are notoriously difficult to kind of get close to. The mountain habitat is so huge, it takes a lot of hard work to get around in, and the animals up there tend to be very kind of solitary. So I think all the animals in the show were pretty difficult, but perhaps for me the hardest was the snow leopard, who's probably the star of the show.
In the Himalayas.
That's right, in the Indian Himalayas.
And you managed to find a number of snow leopards, and they even capture a fight between them.
That's right. We were incredibly fortunate. Using the kind of amazing local guides that we got to know in India, we were able to get closer than ever before, and had the most amazing surprise of an encounter between 4 snow leopards. We looked into it, and it seems in recorded history there's only other 2 other incidents of people seeing that many cats. But certainly it's never been filmed before.
This was 2 males both trying to mate with 1 female, and that female's cub, who had to get away from the scene because the males would kill the cub.
That's right. I mean, the threat of the males to the cub is something entirely kind of unknown and new to science. So our local guides there interpreted that behavior. We had to kind of work with them quite closely to find out what we thought was going on, because this is behavior that people just haven't witnessed before.
And is there a human being on scene there, or is it just remote cameras?
No, that was all the encounter between the 4 cats was filmed by our cameramen. So there were 2 amazing wildlife cameramen, and had a big team of support around them, and they'd been following the mother and cub for a couple of days when suddenly all these males suddenly appeared, and they were just on hand to film this amazing event. And because we had 2 cameras, we were able to get different positions on the same action. So it meant that the action was you know, much more interesting.
And what about microphones? How do you get the sounds that you're able to capture?
It's really hard because of the distances. We film with long lenses. But increasingly nowadays in wildlife filming, we do a lot of sound recording in the field. And for things like the camera traps with the snow leopards, these smaller cameras often have built-in mics. So when you hear the sound of the cat calling, for instance, at the start of the mountains episode, that's the sound that the cat actually makes.
Wow.
So it's all for real.
You also used a paraglider to get bird's eye shots of golden eagles in the Alps.
Well, part of the remit of the series, really, that made it slightly different from the first Planet Earth series was to be more immersive, if you like, and to film more from the animal's perspective. And I always thought how exciting it would be to film from the point of view of a golden eagle high above the very highest mountains. We used a number of techniques, but one of them was employing a guy who is the world champion paraglider. And he's able to fly at really fast speeds with a shortened paragliding wing and buzz the slopes to get a kind of approximation of what a bird's eye view of flying above the mountains at speed would be like.
You bring up climate change right in the beginning of the series. Was there a big difference that was noticed by people who were putting together Planet Earth 2 between the time a decade ago when Planet Earth 1 came out and now?
I think so, yeah, definitely. I mean, we did go to some different locations, and I'm always asking the people on the ground what they're seeing that's new and what's changed. And say for the snow leopards, we talked a lot to the local people, and they've had a tremendous glacier shrinkage and a lack of snowfall in the winter over the last few years, and that's led to direct water shortages for them. There's even a black market for bottled water in the capital there now. So they're having to deal with kind of real consequences on a daily basis, and those things are definitely seem to be accelerating.
That's Justin Anderson, a producer for Planet Earth 2, which is airing on BBC America on Saturdays through March 25th. Justin, thanks so much, and please keep making these.
Thank you for having me. Glad you enjoyed it.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.